This isn't going to make anybody feel better, I know. But what's happening in this economy right now is what's supposed to be happening in this economy right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 19th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Okay, stick with me on this one, would you? Because there are going to be some twists and turns along the way to our first story today. We have a lot of inflation in this economy, right? Right. And the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to get it under control, right? Also, right. And one of the ways that's manifesting is that the stock market is sagging. We've been talking about that, and that, as we've been saying, is kind of okay with the Fed. It tightens up on what are called financial conditions. And that is what is supposed to be happening. The other thing that's supposed to happen as the Fed raises rates, as money gets more expensive, that is, right, is that consumer demand is supposed to slow down. And oh, look, it is. And that, at long last, gets us to the Marketplace word of the day and our lead story. Inventory is the word. For the better part of this pandemic, retailers have been moving from just-in-time inventory management to what you might call just-in-case inventory management. Instead of stuff arriving at stores regularly and consumers being able to snap it all up quickly, retailers have been beefing up their inventories, keeping plenty of goods on hand because who knows when supply chains might snap or shipping prices might spike even more, than they already have. And over the past couple of days, there have been signs that all that extra inventory that retailers have been piling up is coming back to haunt them. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
This week, we learned that some big retailers are stuck with too much inventory.
Walmart, Target, even through the department store space.
That's Steph Wissink, senior research analyst at Jefferies. Many of the goods that are piling up are the items consumers had been buying a lot of during the pandemic. Things like office furniture, home decor,
kitchen appliances, things that are on the tabletop and the countertop, even things like basic and casual apparel.
But since the economy's reopened, consumers are less interested in buying those goods and more interested in spending on services like going out to eat. Mickey Chada, a senior credit officer at Moody's Investors Service, he says being stuck with a lot of inventory is not ideal for retailers.
When you're looking at a cost of these items, they're more expensive. And they take a lot of space to store.
And that storage is costly, too.
You're paying for inventory. You're putting it in your warehouse. You have costs associated with that. And so the key is to keep that inventory flowing.
And that means markdowns, which are also not ideal for retailers, says Brian Yarbrough, consumer research analyst at Edward Jones.
Maybe you mark it down 20% off. Maybe it's 40, maybe it's 50. And when you do that, that means your profits get squeezed. And potentially, if you have to mark it down too much, you end up losing money on that product.
Retailers are stuck with all this extra inventory because they made some lousy forecasts about consumer spending, says Nicole DeHoratius, a professor at the University of Chicago.
We have a saying that forecasts are always wrong. And I think forecasting in normal times, forecasting is incredibly hard. And in these times, it's extremely hard.
DeHoratius says Target and Walmart are probably pivoting to stocking more food and other basics. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Uncertainty, right? That's what we're talking about there. On Wall Street today, things were calm-ish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, a different kind of inventory problem now, commodities, agricultural commodities to be precise. We've been talking pretty much since the Russians went into Ukraine about what that invasion would mean for the global food supply. Spoiler alert, nothing good, right? Also not great on that same topic is the weather in the American Midwest. Wet and rainy, not great for getting crops in the ground. So we did what we usually do when ag comes up in our content meetings. We got our Iowa corn and soybean farmer, April Hemmes, on the phone. April.
Well, Kai Rizdahl, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, you know what? A lot has changed since the last time we've talked. What's happening in the world?
Well, there is a lot going on, all of which we will get to. But let me ask you this, since this is the reason we called. I heard you talking to Andy just as I was sitting down, our producer getting things set up. And you said it was a beautiful sunny day there in Iowa. And that is not the way it's been, which is why we got you on the phone. Weather's been terrible. Planting has been delayed. Discuss.
Yes, I'm at least 2.5 to 3 weeks behind, but I did finish late Monday night, so that's good.
Okay, but look, let me ask you this. Why does it matter that planting is late, like a couple of 3 weeks? Because don't you just like harvest at the back end 3 weeks late and boom, Bob's your uncle and you're done?
Oh, if it were only true. No, the more delayed you get, that means the yield goes down. And it's all because of what we call GDU, growing degree units. So heat units. That corn has to have that hot, humid Iowa, Illinois, wherever weather. Plus, you're not putting it into ideal soil conditions because it's wet. Huh. That's what it all adds up to.
And so that means there's less yield, which means you make less money and there's less product on the market, right? In an already tight food environment, right? Prices are already high. Right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I said, of all years, the world needs our commodities. This was not the year to have a late planting.
Right. So let's get to that other stuff that has changed since the last time you and I talked. And there's like three or four of them. The first one is when we spoke in like January, you were worried about inputs, right? About being able to physically get the stuff you need to grow your crops and the prices of them. Did you get it? And did you get, you know, robbed trying to get all that stuff that you need to put in the ground?
Well, that's quite the question there.
I feel like I
got fleeced. Yes, but you know, they can charge what they want. Yeah. For example, my glyphosate or Roundup, which is usually $25 a gallon, I have to pay almost $75 a gallon now.
Really?
And that's all, well, that's made in China. So getting it here, yes, I have everything, but at an inflated price. But I can still make money planting corn on corn because the price is so high.
Yeah.
Although it's a sea of red today, everything's going down. So, hey, that's markets.
Yeah. Okay, so inflation. It's you know, everybody knows the numbers, right? 8.5% on the CPI, 8.3%, and 40-year highs and all that. You, as a working farmer, what does that mean for you?
You know, we're sitting around wondering, is this the new normal? Because a lot of times our input prices will go up when the price of the commodities goes up.
Right.
But yet it doesn't come down as quickly. So it's always a guessing game. Get that crop sold ahead when you know you're making money and wait for the prices. So
what does it mean for you? What does it mean for you, April, if this is the new normal? If Jay Powell can't do what he's, you know, really trying to do, which is get it under control. What does that mean for you?
Well, it means I have to borrow a whole lot more money, you know?
In a rising interest rate environment, right? Rates are going up and you're borrowing more money.
Exactly. I farm on a line of credit.
Yeah.
And I already bumped up against my limit and told my banker, well, I need more. And he goes, suck it up. He goes, sell some of your crop that I know you have in the bin. And I go, okay. But we're going to have to borrow more money, pay more interest rates. So what we do is just farm the margins, as I said in an interview before. You just got to make sure that margin is there and we're still making money.
When is harvest season? Remind me. When can we call you back and see how you did?
Oh, you can come and drive my combine again in October on a lovely, warm day. Yes. No, usually October. But this year, it's probably going to be into November, and then weather gets kind of iffy up here.
I was just going to say, I'm not coming in November. It gets cold out there. I'm not doing that.
Yes, it does. All right.
April Hemmes, she's our corn and soybean farmer out in Iowa. April, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet.
Well, The latest list I've seen shows that about a dozen super yachts owned by Russian oligarchs have been seized by American or European authorities. Total value somewhere north of $2 billion. That, though, the seizing them, that was the easy part, because as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the European desk in London, now that they have gotten their hands on these super expensive ships, Western officials got to take care of them, too.
From her home in the port city of Barcelona in Spain, Alex Finley has become adept in the new sport of spotting oligarch super yachts with eye-watering price tags.
Solaris, which was here in the port for a number of weeks, and I saw her when she was out running sea trials, is reportedly worth $600 million.
The boat, owned by Roman Abramovich, slipped out of the port 2 days before the oligarch was sanctioned. Finley, a novelist and former intelligence officer, is a keen observer of oligarch superyachts. Her latest novel featured one of these palatial craft.
They have sometimes more than one helipad, full-size swimming pools, dance floors that turn into swimming pools. The opulence inside of these is incredible.
And the paranoia of their owners just adds to the cost.
Some of them have anti-missile defense systems on them. They have state-of-the-art radar systems. These are yachts that really require an enormous amount of maintenance and an enormous amount of money constantly going into them.
And that's a problem for the authorities detaining some of these vessels under the sanctions. Finley says about a dozen super yachts have so far been detained pending inquiries, or they've been seized. Like a vessel belonging to Kremlin-connected billionaire Andrei Melnichenko. Italian police boarded and detained it 2 months ago, but the elation of that moment has waned.
There was, at the beginning, there was this a little bit of glee that some of these authorities were seizing these yachts, but now the reality sets in.
The reality is the cost of mooring and maintaining these thoroughbred leviathans. Sam Tucker is with Market Intelligence Group, Vessels Value.
So these things have enormous running costs. It's about 10% of the yacht's value is what should be spent every year.
That's 10% of some stratospheric numbers. Alisher Usmanov's super yacht Dilbar, seized in Hamburg, has a market price of around $750 million. Mooring and upkeep will be ruinous. But without that essential maintenance, Tucker says, a super yacht will depreciate fast.
You could see perhaps 50% of the value be taken off these yachts.
The problem for the arresting authorities, says Tom Keating, head of the Centre for Financial Crime and Security Studies in London, is that the oligarchs can't pay for the upkeep of the super yachts as their bank accounts are frozen.
As it stands, the onus and the liability lies with the government that has arrested the vessel.
The arresting governments can't sell the yachts. Under current US and European law, the vessels still belong to the oligarchs, and neglecting them could also be very costly.
One can assume that the lawyers for the oligarchs will be arguing, well, look, you know, we weren't able to maintain this vessel. It's lost tens of millions of value whilst you have arrested it. Therefore, we're going to sue you for that loss.
Moves are underway in the US to allow the authorities to sell the seized yachts to defray the upkeep costs and raise money for Ukraine. Nothing similar has surfaced yet in Europe, where most of the vessels have been detained, and Alex Finley isn't sure how much of a market there'd be for such confiscated property anyway.
I'm not sure that I would want to be sailing around the Mediterranean on the yacht of a pissed-off oligarch.
Dozens of oligarch yachts are thought to have eluded the authorities and to be either on the move or moored beyond the reach of sanctions. The authorities may be quietly relieved. One of the vessels that got away, Abramovich's most expensive, the Eclipse, is said to be worth more than $1 billion. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Just step on it and drive like a madman.
Or, you know, maybe don't. Just saying. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 236 today, 0.75%, finished at 31,253. The S&P 500 down 22 points, about 0.5%. 3,900. The NASDAQ, rather, fell 29 points, 0.2%, 11,388. Looking at some agricultural stocks, since we were talking to April, Farmland Partners grew 0.25%. CF Industries, they make fertilizer, dropped 0.1%. Majority of CEOs surveyed by the Conference Board are expecting a recession. 57% are feeling a short, mild recession coming on. Most of them are also expecting inflation to come down over the next few years. More on recession, by the way, at the very end of this program. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There has been, depending on how you count, something like $4.5 trillion in federal pandemic relief budgeted in the past 2 years. And as we know, that money went everywhere, including higher education. $76 billion for all kinds of things, from COVID tests to direct aid for students. Not all of it, though, has been spent. So today, the Department of Education offered suggestions on how colleges can put some of what they've got left to use, including toward mental health. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that.
Rama Thaherswali is 42 years old. She has three kids and is graduating next month from the Community College of Baltimore County. She's taken 6 years to get her associate's degree and says she sees her fellow students getting stressed by the idea that they have to make it through school quickly.
Like, it makes you feel like, oh my God, I need to finish within this time frame. But it does not have to be on the expense of your mental health.
Thaherswali is studying behavioral health counseling, and she is a big fan of counseling.
In this day and age, everyone needs a therapist, honestly. And even therapists need therapists.
Thaherswali got connected with her own therapist through her school, which used some of its federal COVID relief money to buy a subscription to the mental health platform Togetherall. It's an anonymous online network where students can vent any time of day. The U.S. Department of Education is providing ideas for other things schools can spend money on, such as text-based counseling or suicide prevention training. Here's Education Secretary Miguel Cardona.
Our universities understand that their role is also to meet the students where they are. Some of that is academic, some of that is not academic, and it's mental health.
But the COVID relief funds are a one-time thing. And Bryce McKibben of the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple University says both schools and the federal government need to make long-term investments in mental health.
If institutions don't address student success, they're not going to be able to succeed long-term as institutions.
And McKibben says schools are competing with each other to find mental health counselors who are in high demand. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
First car I ever had was a 1972 Cutlass 442 convertible, cherry red with a white top. Went about a zillion miles an hour. Also felt like it used about a zillion gallons of gas to go a mile or so. Getting rid of it is right up there on the list of the top five biggest mistakes of my life. But honestly, it's probably best I did because, first of all, you've seen the price of gas, I know. But also, because living as I now do in California, specifically in Los Angeles, with that stereotyped but not wrong car culture image, well, we are very serious about our auto emissions standards out here. So enter now a whole network of businesses that is turning classic rides like the one I used to have into EVs. Marketplace's Andy Euler came out here to check it out.
If you want to see classic American cars in their native environment, come to the parking lot of a Foster's Freeze fast food joint on the first Monday of the month for a meeting of the San Diego Association of Car Clubs. There are a couple dozen American classics. There's a 1969 Pontiac Firebird, a 67 Chevy Camaro, and a coupe that Paul Alvarado's been bringing to car shows for a while now.
I've had this 1940 Mercury since 1965. I used to drive in high school. Yeah, it was given to me by the original owner, and didn't look like this.
Cars like these on display are embedded in California culture, but so is caring about the environment. Solar panels on rooftops and electric cars. Alvarado says he doesn't think it makes sense to combine the two.
I could see there's going to be an electric car in my future someday. I don't know when, you know, but as far as converting a classic car like this, I just wouldn't be interested.
But a ton of folks are. Just about a 15-minute drive up Interstate 15, David Bernardo's hot rod business caters to him. It's called Zelectric, and it has a 2-year waiting list for services that start at $68,000. And that's if you bring your own vehicle.
Well, let's take a spin in this 1969 Porsche 912.
We get in, and Bernardo turns the key.
So it starts up the same way as your original car did, except there's a little beep.
Starts up in the same way, except not at all. Just one little beep. But once you get it on the road, it responds even better than it would have when it came off the assembly line.
You know, I just can step on it and drive like a madman, or I can kind of go incognito and just cruise around in an old sports car.
The body is old, but the guts are pretty new. The motor in this Porsche was taken out of a totaled Tesla. The company that supplied David Bernardo with that motor is another half-hour drive north on the 15 freeway. It's called EV West, and it's at the heart of the Southern California network that's electrifying classic cars. Founder and CEO Michael Bream met me in the company's garage.
Really what we try to do here is develop all the products and the kits and develop it for, you know, guys like David and, you know, all the other guys basically doing this.
A kit to do a basic conversion of your own car into an EV is about $20,000. Right now, his market is basically celebrities and rich people.
We are talking about classic cars, so even if we left electrification out of it, classic cars in general is something that people with means get involved in, right? So we're not really changing the formula, and we're not even changing the demographic. We're just changing the product that we're selling.
But a 2-hour drive north in South Los Angeles, a company called Zero Labs is convinced that EV conversions don't have to be just for drivers with lots of money. Right now, it's electrifying Ford Broncos and Land Rovers, two vehicles that have a passionate user base. Currently, there are fewer than half a dozen Zero Labs vehicles on the road, but Adam Rowe, the company's CEO, says he wants to convert more to tackle the problem of waste. He says about 20% of all cars eventually end up in landfills. So in addition to cutting exhaust emissions, converting every kind of used vehicle into an EV will cut out a lot of garbage.
Because this is much bigger than just classics. Like, we're starting with classics because that addresses that's the green premium market. But 5 years from now, I want to be doing school buses and federal fleets and mail trucks and things. Like, there's no reason why we can't.
Rowe says he can't do it now because there are no economies of scale. And he says those are only going to come with substantial investment and a commitment from the automotive industry to stop thinking about EV conversions as a niche market. In Southern California, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I feel like we kind of need to do a quick vocabulary reminder because people are starting to toss the R word around with some regularity. R, of course, for recession. Once upon a time, the standard definition of recession was two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. Like, for instance, last quarter was negative economic growth, right? GDP shrank 1.4%. And according to the old rules, one more quarter like that, boom, recession. But these times are not the old times. The people who get to decide officially, by the way, when we are in a recession are the members of the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. And here is their definition of recession. I don't know, maybe this will come in handy at a dinner party or something. Anyway, the NBER says a recession is, and this is the quote, a significant decline in economic activity that is spread across the economy and lasts more than a few months. In our interpretation of this definition, they go on, we treat the three criteria, depth, that is, right, a significant decline, diffusion, that is, spread across the economy, and duration, more than a few months, as somewhat interchangeable. So, that whole two consecutive quarters thing, no. All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context. We started with something that wasn't going to make you feel better about this economy, right? We're going to end in the same place. First-time claims for unemployment benefits came in this morning. 218,000 people lost their jobs last week, the most since January. And again, this is not going to make you feel better, but that is exactly what Fed Chair Jay Powell has been talking about, taking just a little bit of steam out of what is still a really strong labor market. Amir Bawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek as well, are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.